Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today is a potpourri of reminiscences around this Gemini aspect of the zodiac, which include earthquakes, floods, battleships, and marbles. I wrote most of it, so I give my ambidextrous disclaimer that these reflections and images just might be my opinion only in all the snake-eyed, dualistic cosmos. I'll start with my Father's Day. This year, Father's Day falls on Juneteenth, which is Black Liberation Day. Coincidentally, the first Father's Day was on June 19th, 1910, but was switched to the third Sunday in June. For me, however, today, June 2nd, is the true Father's Day. My father, William Copeland McCusker, was born 103 years old today in 1913. His life lasted 84 of those years. He died on February 6, 1998, a sort of reverse numerology, born 6-2, died 2-6. He was born of Irish-American parents with a dab of English on the maternal side. His ancestry included Revolutionary General Nathanael Greene and a once-renowned Indian killer. He wed a Sicilian whose father was an immigrant and her mother born just off the boat from Sicily. He and my mother Josephine grew up together. They had three children, of which I was the first, born in 1941. He spent most of his adult life in the legal drug trade, making and selling topical and oral medicines and medications, and he was a first-class, first-aid, emergency Red Cross volunteer many years before EMTs appeared on the scene. I became an EMT because of him. After my father's death, my family delegated me to write a short eulogy for his friend, the parish priest, to read at his funeral. My initial attempt was cut to pieces by my mother, her sister, who was also my godmother, and my two siblings. Each had their own strong versions of the meaning of his life, and I eventually came up with a satisfying composite of our separate images. My favorite image is of him as a young man, 20 years old, when he volunteered to drive much-needed medical supplies to the earthquake-stricken city of Long Beach, California, in March 1933, at great risk to his life from aftershocks and crumbling buildings. The earthquake occurred in the late afternoon of March 10th, south of downtown Los Angeles. Its epicenter was offshore, southeast of Long Beach, at a magnitude of 6.4 along the Newport-Inglewood Fault. The quake was felt almost everywhere in Southern California and in the San Joaquin Valley, the Coast Range, and Sierra Nevada Mountains. It was also reported in northern Baja California. Although the earthquake was moderate in terms of magnitude, it caused serious damage and killed at least 120 people. Damage was especially severe to weak masonry structures built on landfill in Long Beach and nearby Compton. Collapsed houses were pushed from their foundations, building walls were knocked down, and tanks and chimneys fell through roofs. Aftershocks that occurred for several days continually littered streets with falling debris, which my father was forced to drive through with his rescue supplies. I don't know how many trips he made over however many days of aftershocks and collapsing houses and buildings. My father was a rather reticent man, and most of what I learned about his emergency and rescue work was either told to me by his friends or from first-hand experience because I happened to be with him when something happened and he enlisted me into whatever needed to be done, whether tightly grasping the pressure point on the arm of a bleeding nun injured in a traffic accident while he bandaged her when I was 8 or 9, or tending to smoke inhalation victims of a house fire when I was a teenager. I remember a train crash at Los Angeles' Union Station in which hundreds were injured that he helped assist, and the suicide of a young girl he told me about who said she wanted to change her mind after jumping out of a window of a building in downtown LA. I think, however cogent the images of my family, my image of my father is as the young rescuer risking his life to aid earthquake victims is the one he and I share. And I will surely think of him when the long-anticipated Cascadia quake ruptures and drowns the Oregon coast and probably much of the rest of the Pacific Northwest, maybe today. And now about the flood. Vanport, the town nobody wanted. And I wrote this also. One of the world's worst examples of city planning was Vanport, Oregon, the city where Portland's Delta Park is now. When it was dramatically submerged like a latter-day Atlantis on Memorial Day in 1948, Vanport had a population of almost 20,000 persons, all of whom were made homeless by the rampaging Columbia and Willamette Rivers in less than an hour and a half. A faulty dike system was the cause of Vanport's death. The water poured through a break in an old railroad embankment, and for weeks, Vanport was at the bottom of a lake. Vanport was the second largest city in Oregon during World War II, a war baby born of the necessity for housing some 40,000 workers for Henry J. Kaiser's shipyards in Portland and Vancouver, Washington. Former Portland Mayor Earl Riley described it as the largest housing project in the nation. Vanport was built in 1942 on marshy lowlands along the Columbia River, less than 2 miles from where the Columbia merges with the Willamette River. Touted as the miracle city on the Columbia that Kaiser built, Vanport was never more than a huge collection of cracker boxes strung together fast and cheap, according to one of its residents. But from its conception, Vanport was more than just a war baby. It was a bastard child. It had no mayor or city council, but was instead administered by the Portland Housing Authority. It had no local industry except for gas stations and grocery stores. It had a population of blue-collar workers, at least one-fourth of whom were blacks, recruited by Kaiser from southern states. After the war, Portland used Vanport as the dumping ground for human waste, a former resident said. By the time the flood wiped us out, it was almost all low-cost housing for the poor. The City of Roses made no pretense of hiding its fears that Vanport was a slum in the making, a potential cesspool of crime, a debaser of real estate values, and a prospective leech on the tax roll, Walter Matala wrote in the Oregon Journal a year after the flood. Matala, who had lived in Astoria, also wrote about the Great Astoria Fire of 1922. As the largest housing project in the nation, Vanport could become the biggest municipal headache of its time, Portland Mayor Riley said in October 1945. Julia Rutila, who was fired from her job with the State Welfare Division for her investigative reporting of the flood, said that after the war, the power structures in Portland and Vancouver wanted all the blacks to go back where they came from. Many of them did, she said. But at least one-fourth of Vanport's population at the time of the flood was black. The other largest single group was veterans who came to Vanport after the war and couldn't find jobs. Because of that situation, one-fourth of the city was on welfare. I think that because the majority of Vanport's population was poor, Ms. Rutila continued, black and white, whether on welfare or working at low-paying jobs, the Housing Authority just didn't care to meet its responsibilities to the people. Never has a city grown so big so fast, lived so short a life, and died so suddenly with so little loss of life, Leverett Richards wrote about Vanport in the Oregonian on the 20th anniversary of the Memorial Day flood. At least a score of Vanport's residents died in the flood. Thousands lost everything they owned. It might seem that the planners who built the city in a swamp between two rivers would deem flood control as a first priority. All we had in Vanport was a makeshift, leaky dike system and no little Dutch boy to plug it with his finger, a survivor said 25 years after the disaster. The dike that broke had been an old railroad embankment constructed of sand and soft earth that was, quote, never intended to resist the powerful lateral hydraulic pressures of a flood or protect a town, an editorial in the Portland Sun said 3 days after the dike burst. The Oregon media agonized over the Vanport disaster, but all it could do was raise questions for which there were obvious answers, and just as obvious, a desire to avoid them. Former Oregonian reporter Bob Clark, whose Vanport home was destroyed by the flood, posed one of the questions a month later. "We have learned that the Columbia long had regarded these murky bottoms as her own property," he wrote. "We have been told that she swept through from time to time when the Snake, Willamette, or other tributaries dumped too much water into her main channel." Did the men who built Vanport know that? Clark asked. Julia Rutila said they did. She said several members of the Army Corps of Engineers had warned the housing authority before Vanport was built that the area was one of calculated risk. "But I don't think they really cared," she said. "Portland didn't want the blacks, neither did Vancouver. That was one of the main reasons Vanport was built, and I seriously believe a reason the housing authority chose to go ahead and build the city in that area of calculated risk." Hours before the floodwater swept through Smith Lake, Army engineers and housing authority officials inspected the dike and reported it in good shape. By that time, the housing authority had moved its records out of Vanport, and the supermarkets moved their safes, Miss Rutila said. All they left behind were the people. Residents had become increasingly worried when the rivers began rising before the fateful Memorial Day. Unseasonal runoff of late snow and several days of heavy rains had swollen the Columbia and Willamette Rivers to levels not recorded since the 1894 flood that inundated Portland. To counter growing demands for evacuation of Vanport by its residents, the Housing Authority responded with a handbill that was delivered from door to door, proclaiming, "The dikes are safe at present. You will be warned if necessary. You will have time to leave. Don't get excited." The executive board of the Vanport Tenants League filed suit against the Housing Authority a month after the flood. The case, which never reached the courts, demanded the Housing Authority be held legally responsible for not having evacuated the people of Vanport prior to the flood, not having provided an adequate warning system, and for having issued reassuring statements denying any immediate danger. "When people talk or write about Vanport, they only talk about the flood," a survivor said. "They don't deal with the fact that thousands of us were homeless or were forced to live in trailers or in barracks on Swan Island for months afterward. The housing authority did nothing to find replacement housing. We had to find it for ourselves, which was almost impossible because of housing shortages and the fact most of us were financially wiped out by the flood." Ms. Rutila, a reporter for the Longshore Dispatcher since 1946, was fired from her job with the State Welfare Division because she wrote that the victims were left entirely to their own devices with no aid from public agencies. The Welfare Division had declared the flood was a natural disaster and that the refugees were not entitled to relief, she said. The Red Cross took the same position. Churches and schools threw open their doors, and several people took some victims into their homes, but there were thousands. Ms. Rutila said she and an Associated Press reporter went to the director of the Housing Authority after the flood and suggested that vacant hotel rooms in Portland be used to temporarily house the Vanport refugees. "He told us he couldn't do it because the rooms were reserved for Rose Festival visitors," she said. The Army Corps of Engineers says there will never be another flood like the Memorial Day flood of 1948. They say the 14 major dams on the Columbia River and its main tributaries will resist another flood of Vanport proportion. As for Vanport's graveyard, it was designated for recreational land use because no one wanted to live there anymore. Delta Park and a racetrack replaced the drowned city. "The destruction of Vanport houses was long overdue," Dr. Richard M. Steiner, who was pastor of Portland's First Unitarian Church at the time of the flood, told his congregation and the Oregon Journal a month afterward. "The tragedy lies in the destruction of lives and personal property," he said. a different housing authority, more concerned for the people and less concerned for real estate values, would have long since created permanent housing for low-income groups in our city. The city of Portland still has not met that responsibility. In fact, the city is literally flooded with contrary populations of homeless victims of gentrification and home-seeking newcomers wanting to buy or rent rapidly diminishing home stocks, a situation similarly developing in Astoria. As for the black population flooded out of Vanport, many refused deportation from Portland or Oregon and moved into northeast Portland, where many black families had displaced earlier white residents, and despite considerable blight and prejudice, have developed a significantly vigorous and flowering community known as Albina. And that was Vanport, the city no one wanted. And I wrote it for Metropolis Magazine in 1973. Julia Rutila, born in 1907, was a significant part of Northwest labor history for more than 60 years, since she was a child passing out IWW leaflets. She was a small, quietly spoken woman who served on countless picket lines and in as many defense committees for jailed union men and women. She was arrested often and the victim of labor violence by police and strikebreakers. She wrote for the Union Press for more than half a century. She was also active in anti-Vietnam War and pro-humanistic issues, leader of a cohort of elderly women who often wore black and appeared everywhere there was opposition to unjust social, political, and military policies. When she was 80, she expressed wonder she had lived so long and concluded her longevity was due to her white-hot anger at political impropriety and insensitive stupidity, which kept her blood clean. She lived in Astoria for many years, and in Portland after that. She died in Alaska in 1991, actively protesting the Persian Gulf War. In 1974, at my request as editor of Metropolis Magazine, published by Portland State University, earlier known as Vanport College, Julia wrote a remarkable narrative about Northwest labor history of the first part of the 20th century, The Sweat and Blood of Labor, which was subsequently reprinted four times in my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, September's 1982, 86, 94, and 2003, and I have read it several times on this program honoring Labor Day. In 2003, Sandy Polchuk wrote a book about Julia, Sticking to the Union, an Oral History of the Life and Times of Julia Rutila. Walter Matula was a newspaper man. He wrote for the Astoria Budget, the Oregon Journal, and the Oregonian. In the early 1960s, he worked for the great but short-lived strike newspaper, the Portland Reporter. He was a founder of the Finnish American Historical Society in Portland and wrote articles and books about the Northwest Finnish community, among them Finns and Finnegans, Boarding House Finns, Uniontown Finns, Indians, Finns, and Their Thunderbirds, illustrated by Amy Matula. He was also author of Sam Newhut, Empire Builder. He died in 1974 at age 69. And now the battleship, Mighty Moe's Last Voyage, and I wrote that one also. Probably only a very few remember that the famous World War II battleship, USS Missouri, spent a few days in Astoria in the spring of 1998. Yet it seemed at the time, reflecting upon the polyglot mass of humanity who came to see the old warship before it left continental USA forever, that everybody in this part of Western America was aware that a vital relic of the nation's history was shipping out to its Pacific gateway to take up station as a floating museum next to the sunken ruin of the only other battleship as famous. The Mighty Moe was not the most veteran warship when President Harry Truman designated it as the site upon which defeated Japan would surrender in Tokyo Bay and end World War II on September 2, 1945. More fitting would have been one of the resurrected battleships sunk at Pearl Harbor accepting the surrender. But Truman was from Missouri, and USS Missouri became America's most famous battleship, save one, USS Arizona, which is enshrined in the mud at Pearl Harbor, with most of its crew entombed within it. Missouri stayed in service throughout the Korean War, leapfrogged Vietnam, though its sister New Jersey was recommissioned for that war, and served with another elderly sister of the Iowa class, Wisconsin, in the Persian Gulf War. Though Missouri fought off Japanese kamikazes, struck glancingly by one, and shelled enemy shores in three wars, it never engaged in a battleship battle, which it had been designed for in the late 1930s. But it might have at Lady Gulf, alongside resurrected Pearl Harbor veterans that got their revenge on the Japanese fleet. Yet historical what-ifs are like video games, and that they present fascinating possibilities while killing time. Missouri, like her sisters, was left to rot following her final service until the U.S. Navy was put upon to make a decision whether to scrap or preserve. The pressure of preservationists prevailed, which is why the old battleship visited Astoria, under tow from mothballs in Bremerton, Washington, by an appropriately named ocean-going towboat, Sea Victory. Its final destination was Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, where it was moored near Arizona on Battleship Row as one of a pair of bookends signifying America's catastrophic entry and virtually total victory, with help from a number of allies, in World War II, quite fittingly as the first and last memorials to the Pacific portion of the war. Missouri became a brief moment in Astoria's history as a result of the need to kill saltwater organisms clogging her bottom in the Columbia River's fresh water, and to not export Northwest sea life to the islands. An estimated 125,000 people came to say goodbye to the old warship before its last voyage, such crowds as will never be seen in Astoria again, unless, as one man suggested to Mayor Willis Van Dusen, the city hosts the Olympics. Although hundreds of Astorians pitched in to handle the huge crowds, Columbia River Maritime Museum volunteers got the plum of manning Missouri's decks, counting more than 57,000 who came aboard, approximately 1,000 an hour, the 5 days the ship was open to the public. The average wait in line to board Missouri was 3 to 4 hours each day, and once aboard, people had at least two more lines to endure, one to view the plaque placed on the deck where the Japanese and Allies signed off World War II, and another to leave the ship. Almost everyone was patient and friendly with each other, and most said they felt honored and awesome that they stood on the exact spot the worst war in history formally ended. Among them, of course, were thousands of veterans of virtually every war the U.S. fought in the 20th century and the years in between when Americans were stationed all over the world. Maritime Museum Director Jerry Ostermiller called it a veterans' Woodstock. Thousands more came to simply take a possibly last, and for most also a first, dockside look at Missouri without boarding, to see, as Herman Wouk described in his famous novel, The Kane Mutiny, the vast flat steel wall of the battleship's side that towered like a skyscraper and stretched away on either side, seemingly for blocks, the great citadel of bridges and stacks that jutted out of the deck skyward, a pyramid of metal that during World War II was, as Wouk said, nervous in anti-aircraft batteries and radars, and the main battery, the long cannon with turrets that seemed bigger than entire ships. Americans are notorious for being largely indifferent to their history, yet sometimes the collective cord of memory revives, and they respond as they did to Missouri's short visit to Astoria, a full century after the first battleships made the United States a world power. Missouri, almost the world's last battleship, represents what might be considered the nation's high water mark, almost three quarters of a century later. Missouri left Astoria in the same manner it arrived, under tow, disappearing to a watchful crowd into fog that rolled up from the river's mouth late Wednesday afternoon, June 3, 1998. The ancient battleship towered over more recent Navy vessels visiting the city before going upriver to the annual Rose Festival in Portland. the moment the mighty mole moved toward the ocean under tow, another famous vessel, Astoria's own salvage chief, blasted its horn in tribute. I would like to add a personal note. I was a part of the volunteer crew provided by the Columbia River Maritime Museum to guide the 55,000 or so visitors aboard USS Missouri. I was primarily on the surrender deck, helping hasten the crowds through their tour of the old battleship. Quite surprisingly to me, a number of those who came aboard refused to climb the stairs used by the Japanese dignitaries who signed the surrender documents in Tokyo Bay on September 2, 1945. Curiously, most of those who were openly prejudiced against Japanese were too young to have served in the war or to have even been born at the time. Contrarily, many of the Pacific War veterans who passed aboard seemed to have long ago made their peace with their former enemy. I believe I was the only one of the Maritime Museum crew of guides who did not have a photograph taken next to Missouri's main battery of huge guns for a personal memento. I am a USMC veteran of the Vietnam War and chose to have my photo snapped alongside the single, much smaller caliber gun battery that had been manned exclusively by Marines stationed aboard Missouri during the war. And perhaps it might also be noted that Missouri's sister battleship, New Jersey, was briefly halted from going upriver to visit the Portland Rose Festival in June 1990 by Greenpeace activists who rappelled from the Astoria Bridge in protest of the possibility the ship might be armed with nuclear weapons in violation of Clatsop County's designation as a nuclear-free zone, voted into law by 60% of voters. Astoria has no such ordinance against such ordinance. Greenpeace adopted the same strategy of protest in July last year, rappelling from the St. John's Bridge in an attempt to halt a Shell Oil Arctic oil drilling ship from leaving Portland's docks. Besides Missouri's visit, two other significant memories remain from 1998, my father's death and my unsuccessful campaign for mayor of Astoria. And now I'd like to read a couple of poems. The first, by Maddie Lynn, in memory of Stan the Marble Man Brown, 1942 to 2006. The Marble Man, with the shop, by the corner. You could see the sandwich sign pointing there, artistically saying marbles. And if you followed the path, you'd hear the tingle of the bells as you opened the door. You look around and see you've stepped into a magical place, a place of innocence, where a man accomplished his dream, the Marble Man, full of smiles. He greets you with enthusiasm, giving a lift to your heart, a marble. So simple, one may think, yet the complexity of the art is beautiful, and like the Marble Man, could touch your heart. The Marble Man, a pirate of the globes of glass, a saint who took lost souls and gave them hope, and made them feel they belonged. As you pay for that one-of-a-kind marble, only found in the Shop of Wonders, the Marble Man says, don't forget your lucky marble. And that was in memory of Stan the Marble Man Brown, by Maddie Lynn. Stan the Marble Man died on Thanksgiving 2006. He was a remarkably thoughtful and thinking man who was in love with Astoria, and had many cogent ideas about its future, which were distinctly unlike the sophistry emporium that appears to be its new face. He did me a great honor by designing a marble engraved with the North Coast Times Eagle logo, which I consider a greater tribute than a Pulitzer Prize. And a poem by Peter Roscoe, once upon a time a city councilman of Astoria, who wrote this poem many years ago, which I printed in the Times Eagle in 1980. Clatsop, the plains of sand and beach grass, green and gray, metallic sunsets, silver cloud and mercury water, thick surf spit into submission. Some of the driveways, made of clamshell, sell chowder in the house, where coyote killed the beaver and left its feet. Short, squat people sold out quickly, Yankee clipper ships, Klingit slave galleys. A civilization disappeared in the dunes, replaced by neon, guided by radar. And that was Clatsop by Peter Roscoe. And this has been Michael McCusker.